Welcome to Pharma Talk Radio. I'm Valerie Bowling, producer of the show. Pharma Talk Radio is a nonprofit program to disseminate helpful information to those in life sciences, and in particular drug development. And this, of course, always includes patient advocacy communities. When I'm not working with Pharma Talk Radio, I head up content and direction at the conference forum. For information on event listings and radio listings, please visit www.theconferenceforum.org. Today I'm joined by our marketing manager, Annalise Smith, as we introduce a panel discussion addressing clinical challenges originally recorded during the Immuno-Oncology 360 in February 2017.
Thanks for having me, Val. I think what I appreciate about this session is the caliber of the panelists. One of our IO 360 lead advisors, Dr. James Gulley of the National Cancer Institute, moderates the talk between Merck's Dr. Roy Baynes, NanoString Technologies' Dr. Alessandra Cesano, MD Anderson's Dr. Patrick Hugh, and Inventive Health's Robert Millam.
And we're delighted to be welcoming Drs. Patrick Hugh and Roy Baynes to our Rational Combinations 360 program coming up this June in New York City.
Now let's turn it over to the clinical experts to talk challenges and advancements.
Okay, if everyone would please take a seat. Thank you so much. We're going to go ahead and get started. So we're going to be talking in this panel about clinical challenges in immuno-oncology. So to start off with, I'm just going to ask the panel members to briefly introduce themselves. You've heard from some of them today and yesterday, but you haven't heard from everybody here. So we'll start off with Pat on that end.
Patrick Hugh, I'm head of medical oncology at MD Anderson Cancer Center, been in tumor immunology for over 30 years.
Bob Millam, I'm Senior Vice President, General Manager for Oncology Hematology at Inventive Health. I've been in the industry for about 20 years. Most of that time was with a large pharma company up until about a year and a half ago.
I'm Alessandra Cesano. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for NanoString. Spoke about yesterday. It's a company that is developing life science tools and that can be applied in translational medicine and diagnostic.
And I'm Roy Baynes. I'm head of clinical development and chief medical officer at Merck Research Labs.
So thank you very much. So, you know, in clinical immuno-oncology, we have a really interesting area where we have rapid, deep, and durable responses. However, that's not seen in all patients. In fact, it's only seen in a minority of unselected patients. So one of our big challenges and one of the things that we're going to discuss is how do we move forward? How do we get, you know, I'm not really talking about how do we select patients for trials, but how do we get those patients that don't respond to PD-1, PD-L1 inhibition as a monotherapy, how do we get those patients to respond to immunotherapy? Is it all about turning the cold tumors hot, or are there other things that we should be thinking about? I'm gonna start with Dr. Hu.
I think it's a major challenge. The question is, it's very exciting. We definitely cure many more patients than we used to before, but the vast majority of patients don't respond at all to immunotherapy, despite all the excitement right now. And I think one of the major limitations is the lack of T cells at all. Anywhere in the body, from the head to the toe, that recognizes the tumor, there's just no T cells that are specific. So you have to have a T cell receptor that recognizes an antigen on a tumor somewhere. You know, if they're there in the body, you can just simply get them to migrate into the tumor, that's great. But I think there's hasn't been what's called priming of the T cells in the vast majority of patients. And for that, you're gonna need to do vaccines, I think. Either vaccines, or you could do adoptive T cell therapy, or you could do intratumoral therapy, which essentially is a vaccine if you do an intratumoral immunomodulation. So those are the three maneuvers that you can do to make more T cells. But I think that's the next step into getting a huge number of patients to respond to immunotherapy.
So I interpret your question as, so how do you identify folk who need a combination? How do you identify folk who are likely to respond to monotherapy? Because there are a number of folk who have wonderful responses to monotherapy, and you really want to avoid over-treating them with, you know, regimens, which nothing's for free. There's always adverse event profiles that come with combinations. So with that in mind, I think we need to build on what we know and build better biomarkers. And I think David did a nice job of highlighting some of, you know, where we're going there. There's a lot of work to be done there to try and refine the identification of those for whom monotherapy is what they need. In terms of those that then don't meet that categorization or who by whatever other parameters look as though they're unlikely to respond, the big question then is, are combinations the approach, and how do you select the appropriate combination? And at least our working sort of approach right now is to try and identify in a genetic signature type way, as David showed, those who, for example, have a hot tumor but don't respond, what are the actual inhibitory mechanisms that are at work, and try and use gene signature and array type work to try and identify mechanistically logical combinations. And then in the cold tumors, similarly apply an understanding of molecular mechanisms, albeit our understanding imperfect, to try and rationally come forward with appropriate combinations. So that's in broad strokes how we're trying to do it. But, you know, there's a lot of work to do here.
Yeah, very complicated. Lots of... So you bring up a good point about diagnostic and other ways of looking at patients, tumor samples, for instance. So, Alessandro, what are you looking at, and what are you seeing in tumor patients that might be able to... in the tumors of patients that might be able to tell who is more likely to respond to a therapy, and maybe give us hints as to which patients may benefit from a combination approach?
Yes, as you know, was briefly discussed yesterday, I think that really the way we are thinking is that what we need is not really finding a biomarker for a single drug, or a specific biomarker that is one drug, one biomarker, but really develop a tool, if you want, that can be used up front to characterize the immunological posture of the tumor, and really give us information about the different mechanism of immune evasion that could be at play in that particular patient that could, as going back to the cancer immune cycle that was described this morning, really, as was mentioned, each of these different steps at the level of the single patient can be essentially a barrier. And so understanding upfront with one sample, not many samples, because the problem of having different kind of assay with different platform, we run out of sample very quickly. And so really our challenge is to get the maximum information from the tumor, and really having information that tell us which, if the tumor has a pre-existing adaptive immunity or not, and if not, what are the other layer of biology that is at play, including tumor biology.
Yes. Now, I think that's, as we're looking for ways forward to tackle this, I think it's going to be important to understand which molecular signatures may be helpful in determining treatment options and rational clinical trial combinations. So that brings us really to combination therapy, which actually Patrick brought up, with potential for combining something that activates an immune response with something that allows those immune cells to work at the level of the tumor as a rational combination forward. So what do we think are, I'd like to have each of you say what you think are your ideal combination, at least in theory, types of combinations that may make sense. Starting over with you, Dr. Hu.
So I think there we can't just throw everything at the wall and see what sticks, because there's hundreds of studies right now going on in the clinic of combination IO agents. And so the question is, how do we de-risk this and have better preclinical studies, really monitor very carefully what's going on so we can more rationally, once we get a study result, go towards something to give patients what they want. What all patients want, long-term durable survival. No one's ever come to me and said, can you please increase my survival in a statistically meaningful way by 3.5 months? No one's ever said that. They all want to be on that survival curve at the end. So the question is, how do we get them there? We know some principles. We know that if you have your immune cells that recognize the tumor and they survive for a very long time, that's what gets patients out there. So the question is, how do we get these memory cells out there? What we've really focused on in my lab has been to move targeted agents with immune agents to try to get us there, because targeted agents we know can work extremely well, but often transiently, although there is a tail on some of those combinations. But we think that, more importantly, the targeted agents can modify the immune microenvironment and then allow, in a synergistic way, to work with the immune therapy. So, for example, we published a paper that if you lose P10 in a tumor and activate the PI3 kinase pathway, it makes a very malignant immune microenvironment, and those patients fail to respond to anti-PD-1 if you lose P10. It's a very common mechanism in tumors to lose P10. So we're now embarking on a study that just got through our IRB of the PI3 kinase beta inhibitor plus anti-PD-1. So we're real excited about that. So that just shows how we can understand what's causing the resistance to the microenvironment and figure out how to move targeted agents with immune agents in a rational way.
Yeah, that's a really intriguing idea, and I'm just thinking back to, you know, some of the early development programs that I worked on, a lot of PI3K pathway inhibitors, and you know, everybody expected that we'd give those inhibitors to patients, and their tumors would melt away, because why wouldn't they? Because PI3 kinase is everywhere. But I think it's that's a great suggestion for finding out a utility for those inhibitors, which otherwise, you know, haven't been that spectacular, and in many cases have been too toxic. So if you can find a way to do that. I think as well, you know, as we were talking with the previous topic, James, and throughout this, right, we're talking about hundreds of clinical trials, which implies thousands upon thousands of patients. And I think we all know that, you know, patient pool is a limited resource, and we don't yet know exactly how to access the vast majority of patients out there who have cancer and don't enroll in clinical trials. And I think that, you know, to be able to funnel those patients into the appropriate trials is going to require us to reach out further and further into the patient networks, and work with advocacy groups to try to educate patients so that they don't show up in your offices saying, I want that PD-1 inhibitor, and then you have to explain to them, you know, that might not be the best therapy for you. Maybe we should try this, or maybe it'd be an option to put you into this combination trial instead of on that trial. So I think we're going to need to increase our ability to access the data that's in those networks through things like the Flatiron Initiative and Cancer Link. A lot of the major centers, as you know, are collecting all of those data. So how can we connect those data together to give us the right kind of understanding of what patients are out there, and then to get the kind of data that Alessandro was talking about into those patient records so that we can make informed decisions about which patients are available and the right patients for trials.
So my favorite combination is actually mechanistic base. And so it's going to be the one that is informed by the biology at the level of the single patient. Am I expecting that it's going to be different because the mechanism, at least based on what we know so far, some of these signature of immune evasion are different tumor types. And so I would suspect that certain combinations are going to be, in terms of prevalence, more efficacious in certain tumor types. For example, I don't know, inhibitor of beta-catenin or PI3 kinase inhibitors in certain tumor types versus other. It's how the rational combination should really move forward.
So I really like that answer, and I want to ask just a little bit more about that. Do you think that there's going to be a time when we get to a point where we interrogate the person's tumor and there's going to be three things, four things for this one patient, maybe two things for this other patient, and you're going to be able to individualize therapy based on what we see within the tumor?
I think that that's where our aspiration. At least we need to have an aspiration, otherwise we will never really even start the walk toward that particular target. I definitely think that as the ideal is to have tools that allow you for a disease characterization, which the molecular underpinning and the immunological underpinning is more important probably than the histological time. And so in that, there will be essentially information about both oncogenic pathway as well as the effect of this oncogenic pathway on the immunological profiling of the tumor. That will be informative. Will be like right now we characterize leukemia in a certain way, yeah. You know, and so on. So this will be hopefully the way in which tumor will be classified. Of course, we are not going there from one day to another, but I think we are developing the tools that will allow us to go in that direction together with the community.
Very good. Thank you. Dr. Baines.
Yeah, so I think there's no simple answer to this. I think the one truism that at least I think we believe is there will not be a single magical combination that works. I think it's clear from the data you've seen today that there are a large number of combinations that add value to the patient. I think the other piece to this is that our understanding of biology, or however much we think we understand it, it's still pretty superficial. And so there's going to be a healthy degree of serendipity along with hopefully informed observations. I think also there is, and I think David showed this very nicely, we have to get a structural way of thinking about this. David, for example, put up a very nice multidimensional plot where you can basically define things in terms of, let's say, your favorite biologically informative measures. So for example, I think in his graph he had mutational burden, ligand, and then gene signature, and elements of gene signature called out. You can interrogate many, many pathways on that type of matrix and try and figure out, you know, what makes sense for that particular pattern that you see. I think what that translates to is an ever-increasing degree of personalization. So I know that there's been almost a debunking, if you will, of the notion of the value of personalized and precision medicine, but I think we're going to move back towards that because I think this is too complex to take a blunderbuss approach. Having said that, the broad-based studies are very informative, and I think all the companies are sitting now on a treasure chest of material. A lot of this has not been fully interrogated yet because as we work through regulatory process in multiple jurisdictions, we have to hold on to sample in case there's additional stuff needed. But once we get through all of that, I think you're going to see an unleashing of data which is going to be really quite surprising. So I think the reverse translation that David referred to from these broad-based trials is going to be quite helpful in at least giving hypothesis-generating ideas of where to go.
Fantastic. Yes.
That's a great point, Roy, and I think you know, one of the things that you referenced was, you know, we have all these companies sitting on treasure troves of agents and data, and to have some hypothesis-generating mechanism, and I think we're starting to see those kinds of things emerge. I know the Parker Institute, for example, you know, which is agnostic of the pharmaceutical company, gives us an opportunity to have those empirical questions answered in a setting which is somewhat liberated from, you know, the constraints that are present in, you know, at your company and other companies. So I think those kinds of things are going to be really important to leverage to get to understand which ones to advance to the next stage.
Yeah, and it's great because we need many more options for patients these days. So I'll tell you the challenge with diagnostics, and we all think, let's get the diagnostic and then determine whether we put the patient on the treatment or not. But when you have a patient who maybe was just diagnosed with metastatic cancer, they're sitting across from the office and you say, all right, we just did the test. You either have a 7 out of 10 percent chance of responding or a 2%, two out of 10, you know? So even on the patient who has a 2 out of 10 chance of responding, if there's nothing else and it's a 2 out of 10 chance of curing, doesn't matter what the diagnostic is say, you're still going to try that drug. You know, if we said, all right, you have a 2 out of 10, but if I then put you on this combination, you have a 7 out of 10, of course, but we rarely have that option. Usually it's either you get it or you don't get it. So there's been hundreds of papers written on diagnostics and prognostics, and if you have more mutations, if you a hot tumor, inflammatory tumor, but if you look at the cloud diagrams, they're all overlapping. To be informative and helpful to clinicians when we're sitting across from a patient, they need to really be separated. So we know you're absolutely going to respond, or you're absolutely not going to respond. Unless we have magic combinations in our back pocket to give them, the overlap is really challenging for us to use that in the clinic.
And I think that, you know, that gets the more distinction you get between those clouds is driven by the amount of quality that you have and your ability to compare one data set to another. So the closer we can get to bringing those data sets together and understanding how one platform relates to another, the easier it's going to be for us to make those separations between the two. And eventually, there was a question asked earlier in one of the panels, you know, when are we going to be in an ethical position to say, you know, we were with HIV a number of years back, like, we have to give you a PD-1 backbone because that's ethically what we have to do. And that's going to be driven by a lot of things, including economics. So I think this is a really complicated question, but the thing that's going to make us able to make those decisions is better quality data. So that needs to come in and needs to be available, more accessible, I think.
Good. So, you know, as we think about combination therapies, and we've all heard that there's at least 800 combination immuno-oncology studies ongoing, that is associated often with improvements in objective responses, but also potentially increases in toxicity that we've seen. So how do we de-risk the toxicity? How do we figure out which patients may benefit from the combination and which won't, which would likely do just as well on the single agent? And how do we also find combinations of agents that are less likely to cause substantial toxicity? I'll start with Dr. Baines.
Well, I mean, I think there's a fair amount of empiricism in this at the moment, and quite a lot of the toxicity is not predictable on the front end. Some of it is, some of it isn't. I mean, sometimes you would say, gosh, if I put two checkpoint inhibitors together, I might see more toxicity, and that's probably not an unreasonable position. If I have something that I'm combining with, and I think you heard this example mentioned yesterday, an hepatotoxic agent, am I going to see exaggerated pharmacology in the presence of an immunologic manipulation? So I think some of this is going to just be, you know, essentially going to have to be sorted out in the clinical arena, because not all of it is, a lot of it's not predictable, some of it possibly is. I think also we may not be thinking of this completely correctly. I mean, I think there's this desire that we're going to try and come up with a killer combination which is going to be the uber result. And you think back to the story, let's just use an illustrative example, take multiple myeloma. In the bad old days when I was training, the average life expectancy of a myeloma patient was 24 to 36 months. Yeah. Now we're talking about 12 to 14 years. And it's not that we've come up necessarily with the great killer application here. We've actually gone to a place where there are many things that work. They work in sequence, oftentimes revisiting a failed therapy, then somehow, you know, you get a response to. So I think there's just going to be a lot of trial and error here, basically trying to define mechanistically based combinations. There may be multiple combinations for a given possible, you know, biologic setup. It may be that you have to look at cycling, you may have to look at sequence, and I just think it's a lot of work to do. I don't think there's going to be an easy way to do this other than just, you know, working the problem.
Are there any early biomarkers you think we could look at?
Right, so I think, as I'd mentioned, I think you're going to use your biomarkers to try and select rational combinations. Having said that, you know, we've had serendipitous findings where an unexpected combination does something quite remarkable and not predicted from, you know, baseline type of measurements. So there will continue to be serendipity in this field.
Well, in, you know, since you ask if there is any biomarker, just in the setting of melanoma, in which which we do have an approved combination with EP and Nivo. And we have also single agent activity by other. That is an example in which, as Patrick was saying, if you're looking at the PD-L1 is a suboptimal biomarker in terms of the negative predictive value is not very high. So in that setting, if this is the last line of therapy, you might feel like you have to give the best chance, essentially, to the patient. So you go maybe with more aggressive. However, there are some data essentially suggesting that the patient that they have higher level of PD-L1, in fact, they tend to benefit by single agent. And considering the toxicity that is not minimal of that particular combination, is an example of a combination in which toxicity is relevant, then if you have a biomarker that has a high positive predictive value for the single agent, you can essentially use that as a, you know, a cutoff, if you want, of the same, to go with the single agent and with the combination for the negative population. So to everybody gets the anti-PD-L1, but the combination is limited to the people that have the lower probability of responder to single agent as a way of managing risk benefit of the combination, like benefit versus risk in terms of toxicity. That is, of course, we are the signature, the gene expression signature, and some of the other signatures that we are developing are really developed with that intent, or really to separate better the two, or at least have a negative predictive value in the setting of last line of therapy that is very high.
Yeah. Any other thoughts, Patrick?
So I just want to tell you a little story. So last summer, I had a patient come to me with a fairly large melanoma right here in his neck. I tried to send him to the surgeon. He said it was, you know, going into the spine so they couldn't resect it. And so I was trying to decide what to do. Couldn't get him on a trial for various eligibility reasons. Young guy, good performance status, and it was BRAF mutated. And so I thought, well, what should I do? And I decided I gave him Ipi-Nivo, one dose, and I landed him in the hospital for 4 weeks with rhabdomyolysis. Echocardiogram was going down. He needed a plasma exchange. I mean, I felt so bad. One dose of it, young guy, and had no other risk factors. And so it took him months to recover. He came to my office in a wheelchair. I mean, it was just horrible. And finally, he's actually doing great right now. But if I had a time machine, I probably would have made a different decision now, knowing that. So we really need these assays to figure out what to do for these patients. I think it's a critical need right now. The other thing we need to do is start a new science, and that's the science of handling immunotoxicity. Because the rheumatologists, that's a slick field right now. They have things to block IL-17. They have blocking IL-4, IL-6, TNF. And so I think if we can understand and distinguish immunotherapy of cancer versus immunotoxicity of cancer, there may be ways, and you can see this in the CAR T-cell field where they're blocking IL-6 and it's really helping for the cytokine release syndrome and other things. That's a tool we didn't have a few years ago. So we really have to understand the science mechanisms of the toxicity, and then and so we can block it with these slick new agents or maybe develop a new agent. That finally, as we move into the community, I'm really excited that these studies, you know, I never would have dreamed that we were giving an immunotherapy in the community years ago when we were doing high-dose IL-2. So exciting. But as we do that, the question is how to educate everybody. So, you know, if they're on ipilimumab, don't just blow off the diarrhea. Really, you got to get that patient on some therapy right away. You got to really be a diarrhea expert if you're going to give these checkpoint blockades. As soon as you see colitis, if you handle it, you're going to save the person. If not, they can die of bowel perforation. And so how do we educate all of these physicians who see so many different kinds of patients? So those are all different challenges I see and some potential solutions we need to work together on.
So Patrick, you brought up earlier about the potential for priming an immune response with either a vaccine or adoptive cellular therapy, and then coming in potentially with checkpoint inhibitor. What do you think? So with ipilimumab, you're priming the immune response, but it's relatively nonspecific. Do we get less toxicity perhaps by combining more specific activation of the immune response with a PD-1, PD-L1 than with a nonspecific?
Yeah, absolutely, because when we activate with just the immune system in general, with the IL-2s, interferons, and the checkpoints, we're activating every single T cell that's been primed in the body, including ones against the colon. So I think if we can get specific T cells, you can see when we lymphodeplete patients and give them specific TIL cells that just recognize the tumor, they mostly recognize mutations in the tumor, we never see colitis. Now, the challenge with that is the scalability. So the question is how to get the T cells that recognize specific antigens on the tumor, how to amplify those, and make it a scalable way that we can treat 500,000 Americans with cancer. So that's the key. But as we get more specific, you got to ask yourself, 20 years from now, how much allogeneic bone marrow transplantation are you going to be doing? You know, that's a an immune-modulated way to treat tumor, but it actually causes a lot of toxicity. Are we going to be able to get more specific with our therapies and less toxic and in a scalable way? I think that's the challenge, but it's exciting. It's so exciting. We're going to be able to get there.
Perfect. So now we have a patient. We've treated them. Maybe we've treated them with combination therapy. They've responded. Now they're starting to progress on the therapy. So how do we approach this relative resistance to in somebody that has already responded? And you mentioned, Patrick, about P10 loss, et cetera. What are we going to be doing with those patients? How are we going to address those? Because that's another challenge with clinically with these patients.
So we're going to have to put a needle into the tumor and analyze that tumor. Now, with the targeted agents, we're doing a lot of circulating free DNA, and I'm still hopeful that that's going to help us some, but it's much harder in immunotherapy. You pretty much have to put a needle in a tumor, and then we have to really analyze it, because the patient has a beta-2 microglobulin mutation, meaning there's not going to be class 1, so there's no target then if they have that mutation. No T-cell maneuver you're going to make is actually going to kill that tumor. So you're going to have to know that. And knowing that, you would then put the patient on a target agent or standard chemotherapy, anti-angiogenic, because there's a lot of other ways to kill the tumor. And so I think it's really important that we're going to have to get in the habit of biopsying resistant disease and analyzing it for these pathways. And it's really exciting. We're starting to understand what's causing this resistance or escape, as Dan likes to call it. So we can start to analyze it. A lot of times it's mutations in the interferon gamma pathway or mutations in beta 2 microglobulin class 1. Anywhere that puts that target on the tumor is going to get messed up in a resistant population. We never saw it before because we never had agents this effective. The more effective the agents, the more we're going to see this resistance or escape.
Dr. Sasan?
Yes, I'm fully in agreement, of course. And one of the points that we are not talking about is we need to have this test clinically available. Like, you know, we need to really move the science that is so interesting and revealing that we have in translational medicine to the level to the clinic. Because in order to make this decision, then in the clinical setting, you need to have an assay, and the assay needs to be robust and has to be approved by regulators, and there has to be essentially something that we can make clinical decision making, as shown to be clinical validated, analytical validated. So that part is not usually seen so much, but really require a lot of investment, both from the diagnostic company and from the partners, the pharma, and the companion diagnostic process. So this is really something that is not really so visible, because we see the science and that get published, and is very important. But we need to translate. It requires specific skills to develop this particular kind of, beside requirement in terms of money investment and human resources.
Very good. I have one more topic to start to end off with, but before we do, I'd like to open it up to people from the floor. Any questions from? And if you do have questions, please go to the microphone. Yes,
Patrick. So you mentioned a very interesting case of the patient who has this melanoma who responded to the nivo. Can you enlighten us, what are we be doing these days if the patient is immunotherapy, will progress immunotherapy, Will you come back in immunotherapy in the future? How the targeted therapy, would you progress on targeted therapy, CAR to the immunotherapy, and maybe respond again to targeted therapy? I'm just trying to figure it out. How does it work right now?
You're right. It's not clear. It used to be clear. We used to just say targeted therapy. It worked in a high percentage, but it worked transiently. Immunotherapy, it was slow, so if you had time for your patient, then you could have time for the immunotherapy to work, and so you could only do it on slow-growing tumors. But look at the curve for Ipi and Evo. Those tumors go down fast. Now look at the curve, the three-year curve for dabrafenib, trametinib, BRAF MEK inhibitor. There's a clear tail on that curve. And so now it's getting to be much, much more confusing. And so what to give first, what to give second. So that's why we're also doing, like the VEM-COBE PD-L1 study that we're doing with an 83% response rate. So I think in the end, we're probably going to want to just start off with targeted agents plus immune agents. But you got to be careful about that too, because if you pan PI3 kinase inhibit, guess what kind of cell really needs the PI3 kinase pathway? T cells. So you can't just kitchen sink it either. So I think there's going to be, I think in the end, we're going to have to put those two things together up front in a very rational way. It's a great question, though. There are studies to try to look at the sequence, though, targeted immuno versus immunotargeted, but the agents keep changing. That's the challenge, which is fun. The agents keep changing. We're making a lot of progress.
Since you're talking about toxicity, do you know how long do these drugs actually bind to the receptor?
So you're talking about receptor occupancy and toxicity. So that's a good question. And it may, so a lot of these antibodies are actually have 2-3 week half-lives. So they're actually in there. I don't know how long they actually bind and block, but they're actually in the body for several weeks. And so, and the other thing is, it's not just the binding of the receptor. The reason we love these is because you get durable survival. You get T cells for a long time. So oftentimes we'll quell the immune system, the diarrhea will go down, and then we'll say, all right, let's get them off the steroids. And guess what happens? And there's no ipilimumab or anti-PD-1 in the body at all at that point. Guess what happens? Soon we take down the steroids, it could be 3 months later, the diarrhea comes rip-roaring back. And so why is that? Because T cells can survive in the body for decades. And so once you activate those T cells, not only we love them because you can cause anti-cancer activity that lasts for decades, we know that, but you can cause toxicity that lasts for decades. So I think the toxicity is not just about when the drug is there, but we've activated some T cells. We love them because they last a long time, but that makes it challenging to treat the toxicities.
The last question, clinical question. Have you got any immunocompromised patients on the PD-L1 trials?
There's actually is quite a lot of data on immunocompromised patients. I can share a little bit of it with you. I mean, firstly, a number of patients end up, for example, getting steroids to control symptoms. So there's been the opportunity to look at outcomes as a function of steroid exhibition or not, if you believe that's a surrogate for some degree of immunosuppression. And I must say, we're not seeing a difference. So it's not clear that active immunosuppression necessarily changes the outcome. There's certainly work been done in, for example, HIV patients where various trials are ongoing right now, and we're seeing the predictable responses in that group of patients despite some degree of potential immunoparesis, although having said that, these folk are usually on direct antiviral therapy, so you know there's been some reconstitution. So there is an emerging body of data on immune-compromised patients, but it's not a perfect answer to your question.
So, James, just one quick question. I think we talked about, in terms of T cells' role in this new era of, immune checkpoint point blockade. But one thing fundamental about T cells is the T cell expansion also goes through contraction, right? I mean, that's a, fundamental of a priming and then later on the reactivate phase. And it's not a steady like, a typical oncology drug that give maintain the dose. So, in terms of long-term survivors, clearly the T-cell compartment goes through up and downs. I mean, how do we know, or do we have the knowledge to understand that this long-term T-cell impact, the memories? I mean, Rafi Ahmed published the recent paper using the, chronic inflammation model to show that actually that memory cells in a deep niche inside lymph nodes play a significant role. But we'd love to see the panelists' thoughts on that.
I think it's a great point. So the question is there long-term memory? Because they don't have to be at high levels in the body. When we do lymphodepletion and TIL therapy, we pretty much make a transgenic human, and for years they have high levels of the CD8. But do you really need that? Or can they be at low levels and then just amplifiable? You could see that with Malcolm Brenner. He did a adoptive cell therapy. He gave T cells, I think it was against CMV or EBV, and he marked them with NEO so he could see it. Then he couldn't find it at all in the blood. But then when the patient got an EBV infection, boom, they were back. NEO phosphotransferase genes, in the blood. And so they were hiding somewhere, and then they came back. And so I think we're going to have to learn a lot more about memory.
Exactly.
And I think the John Weary, Rafi Ahmed, anti-PD-1, we got to really learn a lot about new T cells. We're probably going to have to also make new T cells to make memory, because kind of rehabilitate them a bit with anti-PD-1, but they're never quite like a non-abused, naive T cell. In the end, we're probably going to have to continue to make new T cells.
Is there a difference in patient that had splenectomy?
It's a good question. We're asking that. The spleen, we often think as doctors, oh, you don't need the spleen, just get a few vaccines, you get your spleen out. But the spleen is extremely important organ, very vital immune area. We don't know the answer to that. We do know you can get a lot of bacterial infections if you have a splenectomy, so I would think it's important. We are looking at things like patients who get radiation, and if the radiation covered the spleen or not covered the spleen, we are seeing some differences in immunotherapy following the radiation, if they covered the spleen or not, that they didn't do quite as well. But James Welsh and a number of people at MD Anderson doing that study. So, but it's a very good question.
Great. So last question, because we're going to be wrapping it up here, I wanted to actually ask Dr. Millman. So this is about big data, and we've heard in the morning discussion about big data, and there was a lot of conversation about that. We heard in the morning both the panel session and the speakers talking about it. We have there's the AACR Genie project, the ASCO has the Cancer Link, there's the CEO Roundtable, there's lots of different groups that are trying to come up with the same idea that, we really need to learn how to get data together. We need to make sure that it's relatively uniform so that we can all be looking at it the same way. How do we do that? And who should be in control of that?
Yeah, it says 000 up here.
You're the czar. You get to decide now.
I think it's a... We have to start with the patient, because eventually somebody's going to ask, somebody somewhere is going to ask, wait a minute, or say, I didn't give my permission for you to use my data like that. Or I didn't, and I think one of the really beautiful things about these NGS data sets is how much data is there. But, we're going to need to think about make sure that patients are making informed, to the best of our ability, choices about what's going to be done with their data. There's terabytes of data now that come out of, back in the olden days, when I was still doing this, it was P32 on a big acrylamide gel, and there wasn't that much data there. Now it's terabytes of data. So I think we need to get patients to come along with us to understand we don't exactly know what's there. That's one. I think that making some decisions about the interchangeability or comparability of how the data is generated is going to be important, right? So what platforms are we going to accept as right? What are the algorithms back behind there that make those calls on the plus or minus for the mutations or the insertions or whichever we're looking at? So we're going to need to make make a decision at some point, just decide this is what it's going to be. And then in terms of warehousing and sharing of that data, I think that we've made some good steps there. I think, you know, in particular something like ASCO's Cancer Link, you know, if it's a public database that's available to investigators to make assessments for their patients, I think that's a good thing. But it's at the end of the day, you know, there has to be a way to pay for that. And where are we going to get the funds to pay for that? Well, it's going to come out of drug development, I think. And so we're going to have to make some decisions about how to make that sort of uncomfortable discussion come to light in a way where it's where there's a lack of an acceptance of the fact that, look, we're just going to have to talk about it. We're going to have to get it out on the table and talk about the fact that this stuff costs money to do, and somebody's got to, you know, at some point we're going to have to pay for it, because otherwise the data's just going to sit there and it's not going to be used, and that would be a shame.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to thank the audience for participating, and I'd like to thank the panelists for a good, thoughtful discussion. Thank you.
The annual Immuno-Oncology 360 Conference takes a unique approach where we bridge the business, clinical, and scientific aspects of immuno-oncology to provide a genuine 360-degree perspective within one event. For more information, visit theconferenceforum.org. Thanks for listening.